For your intent in going back to school in Wittenberg, it is most retrograde to our desire, and we beseech you, bend you to remain here, in the cheer and comfort of our eye, our chiefest courtier cousin and our son. When King Claudius tried to convince Hamlet not to return to his studies abroad, the internationalization of higher education was already a well-established phenomenon. What are the motivations behind today's partnerships between domestic and overseas campuses? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What are the criticisms of such partnerships? What has the University of Wisconsin gotten right, and what has it gotten wrong in today's international partnerships, and what does the future hold? Our guest is Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at the UW-Madison, who recently returned to Wisconsin after 2 years as interim vice provost for academic affairs in Kazakhstan.
Welcome back to University of the Air and also back to Madison.
Thank you very much.
I suppose your presence abroad makes this topic something that you think about a lot. Before you left, before you went away for 2 years, were your views on the globalization of higher education different than they are now?
Well, they were considerably less informed, at least firsthand. It's interesting. Norman began by reading that line from Hamlet. The phenomenon is older than that. The reason the Latin Quarter in Paris is called the Latin Quarter is because in the 13th century, Italian students who couldn't get into the University of Bologna came to the University of Paris instead. So the world's first safety school shaped ancient medieval Paris. I think that before I left, certainly I was aware of the fact that many American universities were becoming involved abroad. And certainly I was aware that large numbers of international students, as we call them, were coming to the United States. I don't think I'd given a lot of very serious thought to the policy implications or strategic questions that are raised by those kind of relationships. It's also true that the last 2 years while I was involved in this project have been a very active time for internationalization of American education. There's the new Yale program in Singapore that's gotten a lot of attention. NYU's program in Abu Dhabi has opened up. They're opening one in Shanghai. I think it's actually opened this year. Northwestern has one in Qatar. Georgetown has something in Qatar. These international or overseas programs are just proliferating. We've always had programs to send students abroad, but these are different. These are either branch campuses or partnerships. These are institutional presences of American major universities in foreign countries, and very often in not very democratic foreign countries.
Well, I was going to say on the face of it, I mean, big picture, it's a part of a big tradition of students and faculty, and I suppose administrators too, getting a bigger perspective on the world. And I mean, it's always been part of education, or for, as you say, for a very, very long time, to get that cultural exchange and the kind of information that goes with it. But then you start mentioning governments that today we would find a little less savory in terms of being under their wing. Let's start with your experience in Kazakhstan.
Sure. So I need to slightly correct your introduction. I was the interim vice provost for academic affairs for this last year, the last 12 months. Part of that, I was a faculty member. So I was at a place called Nazarbayev University. The university is named after the country's president, Nursultan Nazarbayev.
Right away, that sounds a little interesting, doesn't it? A little different?
This university is absolutely the president's pet project. There's probably a better way to put that, but that's completely accurate.
And why did you decide to go?
Well, the University of Wisconsin has been involved in this project from the beginning. Let me back up a little bit and give some very quick background as to how this place is set up, because it's quite different from the way that Yale or NYU or these other schools that I mentioned, Georgetown, Northwestern, are operating. So a few years ago, the government of Kazakhstan, meaning in this case very specifically the president, decided that it would be a good idea to motivate the process of economic and social modernization in the country by pouring resources into the creation of a large-scale, world-class research university. That
wow.
was the project.
That sounds great, doesn't it?
It does. And it's an interesting model. If you want to think about American politics, if you remember back when Michael Dukakis was running for president, he talked about the Massachusetts miracle. And the Massachusetts miracle was the idea that the best way to invest in the long-term well-being of your economy, of your people, of social development is to invest in education, and particularly in universities, higher education and the research that they spawn. So, and it was always, I should emphasize, from the beginning, more than just a matter of economic development. This was always viewed as something that would push forward social development. I'll come back to that in a minute because that story gets complicated and I think even somewhat contentious. But the model that was adopted is, as far as I know, unique. Rather than form a partnership with any single international institution, Nazarbayev University has separate international partners for each of its component parts. So the University of Wisconsin, from early on, we're talking about 2010, became involved with the creation of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences. And there are other universities that are partnered in the School of Business, the School of Public Policy, the School of Science and Technology, the School of Engineering, and so on, various research centers.
And what do you mean by partnered? How does it work economically?
Right. So the partnership relationship is an interesting one. At one level, it's a simple fee for services. Each of these partner institutions proposes a term contract, a 1 or 2 year term contract with deliverables. These are the services we'll provide. There's discussion and negotiation. Terms are agreed to. A contract is signed. And for that period of time, that university attempts to provide those services to the satisfaction of Nazarbayev University. It's actually a bit more than that. These are not sort of client-employee relationships or client-consultant relationships. The partners feel themselves very much part of the project. There are annual partner meetings that last several days, which representatives of all these universities gather in Astana, which is the capital city where the university is located. I should mention these institutions include Cambridge, Penn, Duke, National University of Singapore, some of the best universities in the world, University College of London. So these are very highly placed, prominent American universities, but none of them own the programs, none of them run the programs. These are all locally, I'll use the word owned, programs by Nazarbayev University.
And the credits? The credits are just
purely
from
Nazarbayev
university.
That's correct. There's no credits granted by American University.
So they basically just buy the faculty.
No, they don't buy the faculty. The faculty are hired separately by Nazarbayev University internationally using international hiring committees. Sometimes, on occasions, faculty from partner institutions will visit. So, for example, when I was on the faculty at Nazarbayev University, I was on leave from Wisconsin. But Duke University, during the first year of operation of the business school, will be supplying some faculty on a visiting basis to help them get started. But that's a very temporary measure and very unusual. There's no direct management of operations at Nazarbayev University by any of the partners. No partner has any role in controlling. Well, none of them control anything. They advise, they provide services, they provide consultation. And the university as a whole is entirely autonomous. So it's quite different from the franchise model that NYU uses, where NYU opens an NYU branch in Abu Dhabi
right.
and an NYU program with NYU credits, or the Yale-Singapore model, which is identified separately as Yale-Singapore. But, for example, at present, if a student applies to Yale University, there's a box they can check which says, would you like your application to be automatically considered for Yale-Singapore as well?
and
a much cozier relationship. Yeah. This one is much more hands-off, or arm's length, I guess is the phrase.
So what's in it for these partnering universities, partnering institutions?
Well, that's a complicated question. The very immediate answer is that they are paid for their services. But that really isn't enough. The money that these partners get is pretty good, but frankly, they work very hard for it. For starters, anyone involved in this project travels several times a year to Kazakhstan, and I can testify that that is a non-trivial enterprise. They are hoping to make a presence in Central Asia. They're hoping to expand networking for their faculty and their researchers. They're hoping to expand their global brand abroad, their global presence. They believe that Kazakhstan in particular and Central Asia in general is an area of future economic growth and a future world importance. So they're trying to get a foothold in what they see as one of the important arenas in the world. Think of coming to the Gulf 30 years ago or 25
sure.
years ago, right? First on the ground in places that are going to become centers of the petroleum industry could be very important. I think there's also, I'll call it an ideological component, which is the notion that the world is a global place. It's a global economy. It's a global culture. And part of being a global place is that American universities can no longer be just American. They are global institutions. And this is a physical manifestation
like, yes,
of that fact.
It's just like international corporations, universities
in
need
a way,
to expand.
Sure. They want to recruit students from there, just as corporations want to find customers there. They want to find resources there in the form of research partnerships, research opportunities, even research support in just the way that I suppose you can think of a corporation looking for investors through an overseas presence. We should not leave out a different element, which is particularly, I think, in some cases, less so in others, the belief that American universities becoming involved in abroad is a way to export American values, promote democracy, promote liberal education and everything that goes with that.
Is that the sort of thing that, say, what, a Chinese institution would be able to get away with?
Well, here's where we're starting to get into some deep waters. In some instances, it's very clear, and this is actually particularly true in China, that foreign universities are permitted to operate only so long as they do not present any kind of challenge to the governing ideological order.
Promote democracy.
Well, it's not only democracy, also things like intellectual property rights. In China, that's quite a big deal.
Yes,
Well, and in your own experience on the faculty of this other university where you're a UW-Madison professor on leave,
right,
and you're not really under the employ of the UW-Madison anymore, how did you find that the values and sort of, I don't know, the operation there compared in terms of your academic freedom? Because that's big here.
Sure. I'm hesitating only because this is a complicated question. Right. So first of all, I should probably explain for your listeners that academic freedom as a legal concept in America doesn't mean what most people think that it means. What academic freedom means as a legal concept in the United States is that universities should be free from government interference, which is a fine and important principle, and I think all of us are eager to embrace it. It does not mean, again, as a legal concept as opposed to a philosophical concept, that individual faculty members have freedom to do whatever they want. The university is free to control them any way it sees fit. Academic freedom is about the institutional relationship between universities and the government, not about how universities should govern themselves.
And how does that apply at Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan?
I'll get there one second, but let me just to expand on this thought. That's the legal definition. Now, philosophically, of course, we think of academic freedom much more broadly than that.
And we have tenure in order to preserve the freedom of a professor to speak out in an unpopular way and not immediately lose his or her position.
Absolutely. And you can think of tenure as the second layer of protection. So imagine a professor who wants to speak in a highly unpopular way. The first layer of protection is this institutional notion of academic freedom. The state legislature cannot go to the university and say, you must fire that guy, we don't like him. The second layer of freedom is tenure. University administration can't say, we're firing you because we don't like you. So in the United States, you know, when we think of academic freedom as a thicker concept, it actually has multiple layers. It also goes to what kind of questions we can research. We believe very strongly there should be no restraints on what kinds of questions we research. And of course, at the University of Wisconsin, we're motivated by Mickeljohn's famous formulation, the fearless sifting and winnowing of ideas. All right. So with all of that in context, let me walk through those same layers in the context of Nazarbayev University. Kazakhstan is not, by American standards or by any standards, a free liberal democracy. In particular, press freedom is quite limited. The stated plan of the president since independence in 1991 has always been to first pursue social and economic development and stability and prosperity, and then to move from there to democracy. This is not quite the same as the argument we heard with respect to Shanghai, for example, 20 years ago, if you remember, where people were saying, well, as long as we promote capitalism, that will naturally lead to democracy. This is a very conscious two-stage program from the beginning. So it's very easy to criticize that or even to not take it seriously or mock it. It's worth pointing out that the countries surrounding Kazakhstan, the other post-Soviet Central Asian states, are disasters. And that in comparison, with the exception of Georgia, but if you look at Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan or Belarus or Turkmenistan, you would far rather be in Kazakhstan than any of those places. Be that as it may, part of the – and this is just the publicly stated motivation. For the moment, I'm not digging into any questions of motives. I'm just reporting what the public position is. Part of the public project of the creation of this university was to move toward that next step. We have some economic development. We have some social development. It's not perfect, but it's getting there. The big oil projects are starting to come online. This is the Kashagan project just at the beginning of September this month. There have been announcements about new stakes in that project being purchased by the Chinese government and oil coming online. So there is economic development, and the creation of this university is self-consciously or publicly stated to be part of the next move toward what is variously called social development and political development, with an eye toward becoming more democratic. That being said, there's a long way to go. So the status of this university, which was the question you asked about, Nazarbayev University is governed by a special law, a national law adopted just for it, or just for it and a group of secondary schools. And it is the first autonomous educational institution in Kazakhstan. All the other universities up until now have been subject to exhaustive requirements from the Ministry of Education as to what could be taught and how it could be taught and what the standards would be, all on the old Soviet model. This is the first university to be granted what they call autonomy, or we would call, in the context of our discussion, a version of academic freedom, yeah. Right? In the sense that the government will not interfere with the academic work that is done there. That model has now been expanded. This year, a number of additional universities will be granted autonomous standing. A number of universities will also join Nazarbayev University as being designated research universities. Nazarbayev is the first research university so designated in Kazakhstan. It's very hard for us to recognize the context here. They have the inherited Soviet system, and the inherited Soviet system is mind-bogglingly bad. I'm not sure how else to put that.
In terms of being repressive?
Intellectually repressive. It's an 11-year secondary school rather than a 12-year secondary school program, which results in a certain degree of inadequate preparation. There is very, very strange notions of academic standards and academic discipline and academic honesty. They're building from nothing. So the first step was to give this university its special status. The obvious question I would expect you to ask, and its critics have asked, is how much freedom is there in real life? And here I can speak personally.
How much? You mean academic freedom or
academic and intellectual freedom, however you
want
to phrase it.
For example, you as a professor going into class teaching political thought, what can you teach?
I'll go much further than that. I actually took it upon myself and had the opportunity on about a dozen occasions to give public speeches and talks at fair and very public events sponsored by the Parliamentary Constitutional Committee, the Kazakhstan College of Humanities and Law, other universities, the political party, which is the president's political party, Nur Otan. Some of these were on television, and many were reported in the media. And I can tell you that I publicly took positions on the order of Kazakhstan does not have true democracy and will not have true democracy until there are genuinely contested elections.
And how did that go over?
I never got any blowback at all. I got a certain amount of negative response in terms of comments on blogs, things like that. But no one ever told me to cool it. No one ever warned me I could be heading for trouble. No one ever. There was not the slightest indication that I was in any way imperiling my position or that of the university, much less what went on in the classroom. I taught my classes there in exactly the way that I teach them here at Wisconsin, although the discussions were a little less theoretical.
Well, in terms of exchange of students, I realize that that's not really, you know, what Nazarbayev was or is into at this point. But does that seem that would be a natural outgrowth of this, that UW students would actually attend Nazarbayev and vice versa?
Oh, absolutely. The practicalities of that are difficult, but that's something I personally would like to see very much. And I can tell you that both at Wisconsin and at Nazarbayev, we're talking about that. They are talking about that. They. I am not currently involved in this project. on either side, they are talking about that. I should point out that prior to the creation of this university, Kazakhstan had a government-funded grant to send young people to the United States and Europe for college education. Part of the idea of building this university was to reverse what was perceived as a danger of a brain drain.
Sure.
Let's use that money to build our own university and train our own young people. And so all the students at university attend for free. It's all paid for by the government with the money that used to be used to send students abroad for undergraduate education. There's now a fund to send students abroad for graduate and professional education. So the model that they're moving toward is to have undergraduate education. They hope undergraduate education take place in these new, wonderful, first-class universities in Kazakhstan and then send young Kazakhs abroad to go to graduate school and professional school.
What about the criticism that the brain drain might be for a UW faculty person like yourself to be teaching abroad rather than teaching here? You know, why go there and sort of, you know, be sort of in a sense like a mercenary professor? I'm playing devil's advocate.
Sure, but I'm not sure what you mean by mercenary. I get paid by Wisconsin too, and
you are
Samuel Johnson said, "No man but a fool ever wrote except for money." It is true the University of Wisconsin sometimes acts as though they think I'm willing to work for free, but that's not actually the case.
Right, but there have been columns, op-eds, and others that you know call this sort of thing the Wisconsin idea gone bad, or
sure,
you know, that are looking at it as sort of the university selling out.
Sure. I think the issue in those columns raise has less to do with the idea of a brain drain away from Wisconsin or faculty getting paid, although, of course, that's a horrifying prospect. the issue is, so there's one notable comment whose title was precisely the Wisconsin idea gone bad. There's also a recent column in the New York Times at the beginning of September by Jim Sleeper at Yale, talking about Yale's program in Singapore, NYU's program in Abu Dhabi, and in passing, Wisconsin's program at Kazakhstan. The criticism in all of these things, all of these columns, is that the American liberal arts universities are selling out their ideals. So the idea is that universities have an ideal of spreading freedom of thought, of speaking truth to power, of questioning the bases for capitalism, for example, or authoritarianism, or the working of privilege in a society. And that by operating in these non-democratic regimes, the American universities become complicit in maintaining rather than questioning those power structures. And depending on whom you read, this goes as far as to suggest that the American enterprise will be corrupted. So, for example, there was a contentious issue at Yale where a speaker who planned to speak very critically of the government of Singapore was abruptly disinvited. And the suspicion, of course, was that was to protect their stake in
sure.
Singapore. There were incidents with China. And academics, you know, and of the same sort. Right. The less extreme version of the claim is, well, perhaps it will not alter the way American universities operate at home, but nonetheless it makes them complicit in granting legitimacy to these regimes. And there's a whole range of possible criticism on that score.
But you have to look, I mean, again, at the positive side, presumably, that there might be some coming about of the regime where these American academicians are involved.
Well, now
that's
here,
the idea, right? That's about what we started
with.
Well,
here's that's Wisconsin's version of the idea. So here's where we get to the question of that you raised at the beginning, which is what are the right ways to do this and what are the wrong ways to do this? I've already mentioned there are different models being used in different places, and they have very different implications. So let's start with the wrong way to do this.
And we'll do that in a moment, and we continue with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Howard Schwaber, who is recently back from Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan, where he was, among other things, vice provost for academic affairs and also on the faculty. And we're looking at this whole phenomenon of the internationalization of American universities. And you just said there's a wrong way to go about it. I mean, it sounds like such a wonderful thing, and yet you're saying there's a wrong way to go about it. What's that?
Well, actually, as with so many things, there are lots of wrong ways to go about it. Let me just run through a few of them. So one thing that I think is a poor idea is the franchise model. And I will point a finger here and speak of NYU. NYU has really, with operations Abu Dhabi and Shanghai, and they've been talking about even others, really does look, at least from the outside, like it's just seeking revenue. That it's basically selling its name to build campuses, to bring in lots of money from the supporting governments. There's a reason that they're in very rich places with very rich, you know, very wealthy governments, and paying students, you know, and that there's a very real danger of the dilution of the academic standards that are associated with NYU. Certainly, again, I'm not part of that project. I'm speaking from outside. Certainly there's a perception, for example, that the quality of faculty who are hired on those campuses are not necessarily of the same level who would be hired at NYU in New York.
And who controls it? Let's say it's going to be a NYU in Shanghai. Who sort of sets the standard as to what must be there for it to have the name NYU on it?
Right. Well, NYU does. But NYU will reach an agreement of some kind with a local government. The story is NYU originally went to Abu Dhabi and wanted to just be involved in some kind of project or partnership. Uh-huh. And the sheikh there said, how about I give you some ludicrously large sum of money, you know, and you build a whole university. And they said, oh, we can do that. And I think that's a bad idea. And I'll put this in business terms if I can. It's a matter of diluting the brand, diluting the quality of the product that is delivered. It's the same. It's an exacerbated version of the same conflict we have when we say, look, Harvard gives a great education. Obviously, it gives an education only to a very small fraction of the qualified students. Why doesn't Harvard take 25,000 undergraduates? Wouldn't that be more, you know, wouldn't that expand the wealth? The answer is, well, it might. It wouldn't be, it wouldn't be the same thing anymore. And so I would worry about that on an academic side. On a more political side, you know, I'd worry about what kind of deals you're making in return for that benefit. So both academically and politically, in terms of the compromise of mission, I think one of the wrong ways to do it, in my view, is this franchise model where you have a franchise that is closely tied to the local government. A second wrong way to do it, or potentially wrong way to do it, is a model of dependency. Right? So there are various things an American university can do to prevent itself from being so closely tied with one of its overseas operations that what happens there reflects back on the main institution. But there's a different kind of potential problem, which is if you don't build local capacity, then all you're doing – I use an ugly word – it becomes a kind of colonization. You make yourself indispensable and permanent.
What do you mean by local capacity?
Well, the ideal let's get to how to do this right. I think the ideal ought to be that at some point this operation will revert to local control.
Right.
And in fact, I'll go further than that. I think the idea ought to be that in relatively short order, partnership relationships should change. So I think, for example, if we're talking about a startup, a brand new university being built from the ground up, then there are certain kinds of very positive roles that an American university can play. If we're talking about an institution that's 5 years old or 10 years old or 15 years old, at each of those benchmarks, or 3 years old, whatever the benchmarks are, at each of those points, it seems to me the relationship should change. And one of the things that should change is that the local institution should become less dependent on its international partners. And if that's not happening, if you're not developing the ability of the institution to operate itself as a university at the standard to which it was originally developed to be, you know, if that's not happening, then the project is failing.
And that's actually more of the kind of colonial model then.
It could be. Right? Mm-hmm. You create dependency. You create a kind of pipeline.
Right.
This sort of permanent relationship. It's kind of a core-periphery relationship. You know, and I think that is unhealthy.
What about the problem of a sort of value conflict? I mean, if you think sort of tangent from this Dennis Rodman going to North Korea or whatever. But if you think of American university...
I wouldn't want to try and speculate on Dennis Rodman's values.
Okay. but let's just say American university invited to have a presence in a country where there are some clear violations of basic human rights or civil rights. Or let's say just as an example that within that university, women are not allowed to speak to the same degree as men. At what point does going there serve as an endorsement of those values or a tacit acceptance of them and become therefore controversial?
I think that's exactly that's the hardest question, right? These other two things, these other issues that I've raised I think are important, but that one becomes the most urgent. I think a lot of people who are of a certain age, among whom I certainly include myself, will immediately flash back to the South African question when the issue was boycott versus what some people called constructive engagement.
Right.
So let me talk about a third way to do it wrong. And the third way to do it wrong is for an American university to become involved in a place where there are values issues, as you put it, which I think is exactly right. I want to phrase this carefully. To become involved in a place of that kind without publicly and clearly naming and challenging that conflict. That's where you end up doing it wrong. So you end up doing it wrong if you are teaching in Singapore, and you, whether what you say in a classroom to your students or what your faculty administrators, say in public, or certainly what your faculty and administrators say back home, you know, if at any of those levels you lose this basic edge of saying those are not our values, these are our values, and that becomes compromised, then you're fundamentally doing it wrong, because the positive value of this enterprise, if there is one, has to be something, as I said at the outset, about the exporting of those values, those American values that we care about. There's nothing more powerful than an idea, and there's nothing more important for the spread of liberal democracy, a cause in which I believe dearly, than spreading those ideas. If we wait for Coca-Cola and ESPN to spread liberal democracy for us, as Theodore Adorno warned us a long time ago, we'll be waiting a really long time. There is no direct and necessary connection between Diet Coke and fancy sports shoes and democratic values. If we believe that it is a good thing for the world, for American style, not just American, obviously, but American style, Wisconsin style, liberal democratic values to be spread, surely that's one of the purposes of a university. So now your question, the hard question, at what point are you compromising? You know, how mm-hmm. can you tell?
Well, and that even comes up separate from the globalization question with business of any kind.
Sure.
Like if UW students need to wear Reebok,
sure.
is that a selling out?
I wouldn't want to touch the Reebok issue.
But it's the same question of does a university, by entering into a business transaction where there's money involved, you know, do they in some way become beholden to who's the,
sure.
the people paying the money and also sort of tacitly accepting?
Sure.
Well, that issue comes up all the time. I mean, if you want to talk about research on flavonoids and it's sponsored by Welsh's,
yep.
I mean,
absolutely.
Is that a problem or
yep.
not?
Yep. One can drown in this topic. It's hugely important and hugely complicated. I mean, just in the last 15 seconds, you've touched on sources of research funding, internal disciplinary rules for students and faculty, which are designed around some institutional commercial interest, business practices abroad, you know, an enormous list of possible issues. And I'm tempted to duck the whole thing by just saying it's complicated and nodding sagely. But I'll try to be a little more courageous than that. So let me pick some examples. You know, supposing I was interested in operating a program of this kind, Houston Community College, I might have that name wrong, but I think I read just today that Houston Community College has opened an operation in Qatar in which male and female students are taught separately.
That's a good example.
Contrary to the values,
presumably. I'm not familiar with Houston Community yeah. College, but I presume that this is contrary to the values of that institution, right? So would that be a sellout or a compromise? And let me add two more examples and then answer the question. Mm-hmm. Let us again take a Middle Eastern example, just because in some ways the culture clashes are easy there. Imagine an American university that opens an operation, that wants to admit students, and adopts a rule about modest dress that goes considerably farther than such a rule on, say, the University of Wisconsin campus, especially on Halloween night. But leaving that aside. And for a third example, let's say, again, an American university operating in some traditional society, it doesn't matter which one, let's call it Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is culturally, in fact, very traditional in many ways. And as part of the program, they want to have a course on gender studies in which students are taught to question the ideas of masculine and feminine gender roles, patriarchy, and all that goes with it. All right, so three examples. Dress code, separation by gender, and I'm imagining a fairly challenging and potentially radicalizing gender studies course. I think those are three very different examples. I have no particular discomfort with saying that the rules of modesty in dress at an educational institution need to be sensitive to the local culture. There is a different view. There's a view that says we should challenge as much as possible everywhere we go as often as possible and therefore be as provocative and as outrageous as possible. I'm exaggerating slightly, but one does run into people who do find a positive value.
Then you risk disengagement.
Well, exactly. I mean, the getting in people's faces strategy, the cost is disengagement. And, you know, if you hope to effect change or have influence, you have to be able to engage. And on the one hand, we speak about cultural sensitivity and multiculturalism. Well, those lessons apply just as much in how we comport ourselves overseas as in how we treat minority groups at home.
Which is why you see female American journalists sometimes covering their heads when they're reporting in certain places.
That may be safety as well
yeah.
as sensitivity.
yeah.
But I'll give you an example. American faculty in Kazakhstan, often young faculty, I saw this, would do what young faculty in America often do, which is dress very casually and be very casual, trying to create a bond of equality with the students, trying to get away from the idea that I am important and above you somehow. Unfortunately, cultural messages can be received in different ways, and my perception was that there was a risk that instead of the message being perceived by the students being, this person wants to treat us as an equal, the message was something more on the order of, this person isn't taking us seriously. Mm-hmm. So you've also got to think about how your message is
yes.
received, not only what message you want to convey. Let me take the case of the gender-segregated classrooms. I'm going to say that I think that's a close call. I taught in Pakistan, which is a very traditional Islamic country. And there, the classroom in which I taught had both young men and young women. Had that classroom been physically segregated by sex, I probably would not have complained, but I was only one visiting faculty member. In terms of an American institution, I don't think that that is necessarily, I hate to use this phrase, but a deal breaker.
Well, it would be a deal breaker if it was segregated by race. So what's the difference then if it's segregated by gender?
I think those are actually two demonstrably different things. Mm-hmm. One has to do with the social order within a community, and one, almost everywhere it occurs, has to do with the marginalization or destruction of a community. As a matter of fact, people who are familiar with Islamic cultures in places like Iran and even Saudi Arabia will tell you that there are large-scale parallel structures of business and education run by women for women. It's nothing like equality. I don't mean to pretend that it is, but it's not as though there is nothing there. But let me get the last case because it's the easiest one. Someone who says, well, you can have your program in liberal arts, but you can't teach your gender studies or you can't teach it that way. And that should be a no-brainer. That should be, then we can't be here. We can't operate here. And I want to come back to this point because it's crucial and it's something that has shown up in some of these columns, critical columns we're talking about, and I think the critics have it exactly wrong. So one of the people I think I mentioned is Dr. Sleeper at Yale, and he wrote a column where he says, well, it's perfectly fine to teach business or law or engineering in these regimes, but when you teach liberal arts, you're betraying your values. I think it's exactly backwards. If you're teaching engineering or law or business in an authoritarian regime, there's at least a risk that you are empowering that regime to continue in its ways. You're teaching them the skills they need to be better at it. The whole point of liberal arts, at least as I understand it, is that as long as it is taught without these kind of constraints that I'm referring to, it is intrinsically subversive. That's what makes them worth studying. Studying
because
history,
of the breadth of views that they
the
represent.
Breadth of views, when you study history in a critical way, that's a subversive enterprise. Nazarbayev University has the first university classes, as far as I know, in Kazakhstan that teach the history of Kazakhstan from an American-style critical perspective rather than a Soviet-style hagiography. And we have classes in physical anthropology that look at the Kazakhstan local record and make hash out of some cherished local myths. And, oh yes, by the way, we have courses in gender studies. We sent students, undergraduate students, to a conference in Turkey on gender studies. And these young men and women are learning to think about gender roles in ways that are deeply subversive of the traditional tribal culture from which many of them come. If you're engaged in that enterprise, then you're doing it right.
Which
and so to me,
Well, I was going to say, which is an option that apparently you have in Kazakhstan, but in a lot of other places, including probably Qatar and certainly China, you wouldn't.
Well, I've spoken to people at American universities and American-supported universities in the Gulf who tell you actually what goes on in the classroom is much more provocative than you might think. I don't know enough about what goes on in these programs in China. Or in Singapore. But to me, if I were involved in one of those projects, you know, it really comes down to the basic question. Is the intellectual content being controlled? Is the radicalizing potential of the liberal arts being taken out? And if that's true, then we have a sellout in the most basic possible terms. Let me come back to the Kazakhstan case. There's a point that I think is incredibly important and I should emphasize it. I had much more freedom than a Kazakhstani academic would have had. For one thing, the very worst thing that could happen to me is to be deported and sent back to Wisconsin. There are worse fates. For another, there's no question that I, as a faculty member at Nazarbayev University, as a member of the administration at Nazarbayev University, I had a sheltered position. So it is absolutely true and needs to be stated at the outset that when I speak of the way in which I was able to very publicly be critical of the government without fear of repercussion, that's partly a matter of my privileged position. But in a way, that's the point. This institution is created to push boundaries, and its faculty and administration are taking it upon themselves to push those boundaries. And you can't put that genie back in the bottle. Once you see, you know, people of a certain academic prestige with a certain status, university professors are highly regarded in some cultures, perhaps not in Wisconsin, but in some places in the world, speaking in that way, you know, you can't unspeak those words. And so I really do believe that Nazarbayev University, to take one example, is not reinforcing the authoritarian tendencies that exist in the nation, but on the contrary, in ways both overt and very subtle, challenging them. And in the long run, is one of the most that kind of enterprise is one of the most powerful mechanisms that we have for the export of liberal democratic values.
So you have there, though, at least formerly, if not now, authoritarian regime, which is by implication allowing all these ideas to come in.
Yes.
Sowing the seeds for its own, let's say, if not destruction, but evolution into a democratic
That's exactly
form.
Right. And I think it's extraordinary. And I fully understand the cynicism with which some of your listeners will greet this pronouncement. So let me again be very careful. The official publicly stated position of the president is that this regime is planning for its own obsolescence. The goal is for the political system to evolve in a direction such that its politics will become liberal and democratic in precisely the ways that it is not at the moment. You can readily understand why one might want to scoff at that and say that it's only lip service and that it's not serious and it's not meant. But do you then have this prospect of very large amounts of public resources being funneled into this university? And one piece of this university is the School of Humanities and Social Sciences. And almost everything that is done there is a challenge to the traditionalism, the historiography, and the authoritarianism that support the let's call it, extremely conservative. Actually, I'll go further. The fairly authoritarian regime that is in place.
Well, it may be stretching the point too far, but in the former Soviet philosophy, when you get into Marx, as I recall, for example, there was this concept of the state becoming obsolete.
Yeah, this isn't that. And by the way, that idea kind of went away by the 1930s. The Communist Party ceased to envision its own obsolescence pretty fast.
That's right. But in this sort of a super, I suppose, idealistic way, it's not an idea that you find in this country that the government will gradually become obsolete. I mean, it is a concept that you do, come across over there.
Right. And I think that that's a misstatement. It's not that the Kazakhstan government intends that the government will be obsolete.
No, but I mean that
current
way
of operating. Yeah. Exactly. Well, the form of government is fine. It's parliament, multiple parties and elections and all constitution and all that stuff. It's the practices that need to change. Let me point out a lot of practices need to change. They have problems with widespread corruption. They have problems with radically unequal distribution of economic development, such as in the villages in particular. There's lack of basic public services, or not as good as it should be. They have serious issues of labor unrest. There was a demonstration that ended up with a number of strikers being killed in Zhaozhen in February of 2011 that got a great deal of attention, and rightly so. I mean, there are major, major problems in this place. What we are told, and what the creation of Nazarbayev University is said to be part of, is the project of evolution rather than revolution and growing out of that way of doing things. And they're putting their money where their mouth is, and they're giving specifically the politically challenging fields of the social sciences and humanities free rein and expanding the model to other universities. At a bare minimum, that's a courageous thing to do. And it is not without opposition within the government and within the country. There are plenty of people who don't welcome liberalization. That, too, is a challenge. It's an immense challenge to try and implement those values within an educational institution in a context in which there's very, very little background to make sense of them in a fairly, by our standards, by Western American, Anglo-American, Western European standards, underdeveloped civil society. Or a very large civil society. I could go on endlessly with the challenges and problems, but the role that Wisconsin is playing, at least, in promoting that piece of the program, I think is readily defendable, exactly the way that Emily was questioning.
Some final thoughts about globalization of higher education when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Howard Schwaber, and we are talking about the globalization of higher education. You mentioned that you yourself had seen some criticisms online and, you know, blogs and so on. And when I was looking at some of the articles that are out on this topic, there were a lot of people who then would sound off about, you know, why should American universities be training people abroad who then are just going to compete with us? Some of those people who get education in physics and all these other subject areas, they're going to be better equipped to come up with weapons. And, you know, why are we investing our resources abroad in this way?
Okay, I want to step aside from the specific issue of training and the development of weapons technology and go to the sort of broader issue. Right, so it comes back to a premise with which we started the discussion, which is that the world is irrevocably global, and it's not going to stop being global anytime soon. We have large numbers of international students coming to America, and that number will only increase, which raises some really interesting challenges. How will the University of Wisconsin deal with 500,000 applications from Chinese students?
Is that for real? I mean, is there a huge number of them already?
There is a massive number of potential applicants in China and India who are interested in attending high-prestige American universities. And if Wisconsin or other places is successful in getting its brand out there, then, yeah, some portion of that number will come here. And the scale of these pools is just mind-boggling, just because the population is so enormous. But even today, particularly in our STEM subjects, our graduate programs are full of international students, right? Our country, the United States' future depends on drawing talent from all over the world. It's never been a matter of we create innovation and we create ideas by closing our borders and training our own people to become, you know, good, well-trained citizen. That's kind of the Soviet way of thinking. We've always thrived by attracting the best and the brightest from around the world. So America's interest here is incredibly obvious. It's what's the opposite of a brain drain? A brain magnet. And if our going abroad to train students produces more of those students who have more exposure to the U.S. and U.S. institutions than they might otherwise have, who will think about coming here if they might not otherwise have thought about that, that's entirely a plus all the way down the road for us.
And we see a fair amount of that already. I mean, if you look at, you know, highly placed ministers and even in the Syrian government, you'll see there's some American education there.
Sure. And there's absolutely no guarantee that the fact that someone is American educated, you know, doesn't mean that they'll end up serving in a government that we abhor or doing things that we abhor. There are bad Americans, actually, as well as bad Syrians.
But there will be a level, presumably a level of understanding there that there would not be otherwise.
Well, we can hope so. But I'm actually thinking more in terms of, you know, not the redemption of those particular government ministers, but that I'll accept that in return for the, let us imagine 30 years down the road, you know, 500,000 Syrians who have had some form of American education and saw a different way of doing things.
What would you see as the future trend that you'd like to see, I guess? I mean, you've talked about there how there's wrong ways to do this and so on. But if you could imagine 10 years from now, the various changes that could happen, because presumably this is all just going to increase.
Right.
We're going to have more and more global examples where there's a American university that has, in effect, a branch abroad or a presence abroad. What would you like to see happen?
I'd like to see more of it. One of the interesting things that's gone on in Europe in the last 15 years or 20 years is something called the Bologna process, with which only people in America who work in education schools seem to be familiar, which is this process of trying to regularize and make uniform the recognition of credits and degrees so that within Europe people can travel easily from institution to institution. The process has its problems, but that model, that idea of global mobility through institutions of higher education strikes me as a tremendously attractive one and a kind of virtuous alternate to the global mobility through transnational business corporations. It shouldn't be that business corporations are the only network around the world by which people communicate and travel and become transnational. I actually am less comfortable with something like Yale, which is a closed private operation opening by itself a program in Singapore entirely within its own control, than I am with something like Wisconsin being one of half dozen or eight or ten schools cooperatively involved in building an institution somewhere. I would like to see more of the American public institutions thinking this way and becoming involved in these kind of enterprises in partnership. I'd like to see it being done less as this franchise model and more as this group effort model. I think it's a terrific idea. Difficult, but terrifically interesting, and forestalls many of the problems that can otherwise set in, including a kind of internal sclerotic bureaucratization and even, let's be honest about the countries we're talking about, outright corruption. So I would like to see more. I would like to see it more public. I'd like to see it done in more public ways by public institutions. And a move away from treating the globalization of higher education as a corporate endeavor, and rather a move toward seeing it as a public outreach and institutional development endeavor. I think the future lies that way. I think it's likely to happen. And if we do it right, I think it could be beneficial, very beneficial, for all of us who are involved.
And you're saying that one component of doing it right, though, is to state up front, before getting into one of these relationships, this is not in keeping with what we believe.
The red line, which is the fashion, the phrase du jour these days, is not academic freedom, because that's a contested term. So I'll use a term that I think is less contested: intellectual freedom, the freedom to speak publicly. The president of NYU had a slightly notorious statement not long ago where he said, well, I have no trouble reconciling academic freedom with restrictions on public expression. I disagree. I could not disagree more. That is not what universities are for. That is not what academics are for. So absolutely, I think that the red line is simple. We will teach the same kind of content that we teach here. We will teach the same values that we teach here in the same way that we do, and our people will speak freely.
Has anybody done that, do you know? Has there been a university that has been invited to set up some kind of relationship with a foreign government and said, no, we can't go there? Have they ever said no?
I don't know. It's a great question.
I was going to ask you, too. Are there foreign universities that have sort of the equivalent of branches in the United States?
None of which I'm aware.
It would be an interesting concept, would it not?
It would be a very interesting concept. It would be tough. This is a very tough market to break into because it's so saturated. Mm-hmm. And this is a topic for a different show, I think. but there are actually, you know, contrary to some perceptions, there are more colleges and universities in America than there are students to fill them, which is why something on the order of 55 or 60% of all American colleges are what are called non-competitive. They'll accept anybody who applies. This is one of the untold stories. We always focus on the Harvards and the Yales and the Wisconsins and the Virginias and Texas and Berkeley. There's a whole other dimension to American college education. So this is a really tough market to break into. What you will see, I think, more and more are international universities, non-American universities with branches in other places, in the sense of British, European universities with branches in Asia, Asian universities with branches in other parts of Asia, in increasing what's already started, which is large-scale student flow across the ASEAN nations, paralleling what's going on in Europe with the Bologna process I was talking about, which is student flow within the European nations. So not necessarily, you know, foreign hordes of academics invading America to take over our universities or build their own, but very, very much in ways that have nothing to do with the United States, an increase in the kind of networks of mobility that I'm talking about through institutions of higher education. That will happen whether we're involved in it or not, which is one very good reason for us to become involved in it.
Howard Schwaber, always fascinating, and particularly this time around as you're coming off a long stint in Kazakhstan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.